Tonight we are still on Bill's story in the original manuscript, and it was with a great pleasure that I have the opportunity to sit here with someone who I have an immense amount of respect for, and who has been a very important part of my spiritual life. So I want to introduce Karen. Karen, say hello.
Hello. Hello.
All right, so the original manuscript is going to start on, I think, page 5 in Bill's story. I think we left off, I think we're going to start, that wartime day in Old Winchester Cathedral came back again. So this is the second.
Are we on 7?
Are we on 7?
Yeah.
Oh, sedatives? So where do I start? Do you know, Frank, exactly where I am?
7-1.
7-1. My friend?
My brother-in-law.
Well,
it's 10.
And page 10,
Mike. I have 10 as there as a solution. So.
Oh, right.
My friend down here.
You think we started at Winchester Cathedral, Jim?
That's what I'm wondering.
I think so, yes. I think it's a wonderful place to start.
All righty then.
We need to have the memory.
By the way, that is marked as 10-2. So I'm giving you page 5 because it's off the manuscript. I apologize for that. I should have been more aware. That wartime day in Old Winchester Cathedral came back again. Everybody where we're supposed to be? All right. I had always believed in a power greater than myself. I had often pondered these things. I was not an atheist. Few people really are, for that means blind faith in the strange proposition that this universe originated in a cipher and aimlessly rushes nowhere. My intellectual heroes, the chemists, the astronomers, even the evolutionists, suggested vast laws and forces at work. Despite contrary indications, I had little doubt that a mighty purpose and rhythm underlie all. How could there be so much of precise and immutable law and no intelligence? I simply had to believe in a spirit of the universe who knew neither time nor limitation, but that was as far as I had gone. And what Bill is telling us here is that he's revisiting the feeling that he had when he walked into Winchester Cathedral. Remember we talked about that early on when he had gone to Europe in the Great War, the Great First War, and he walked in there and had been much moved. And then went outside and saw the dog roll on the tombstone. Bill had what stirred inside of Bill was a connection that he had once had that he had lost. And I know that for myself, I had a connection that I had lost, and that literally was the beginning of my alcoholism. Was when I lost that, I began to seek something outside of myself for something that would replace inside of me that assuredness that things were going to be okay. And I ended up spending a lot of time seeking that in sordid places with you guys, actually. Anyway, with ministers and the world's religions, I parted right there. When they talked of a God personal to me, who was love, superhuman strength, and direction, I became irritated, and my mind snapped shut against such a theory. To Christ, I conceived the certainty of a great man, not too closely followed by those who claimed him, his moral teaching most excellent. For myself, I had adopted those parts which seemed convenient and not too difficult. The rest I disregarded. The wars which had been fought, the burnings and the chicanery that religious dispute had facilitated made me sick. I honestly doubted whether on balance the religions of mankind had done any good. Judging from what I had seen in Europe and since, the power of God in human affairs was negligible. The brotherhood of man, a grim jest. If there was a devil, he seemed the boss universal, and he certainly had me.
I think a comment I'd like to make on that paragraph is that as an alcoholic, the delusion that I hold about my control and my disease goes against the pure idea of a God, of a power greater than myself. They just are in conflict with each other, and I see that in that paragraph. Does that mean you'd like me to read?
No, I mean, I like what Karen said. The truth of the matter is, what ends up happening for me is I get a gift from God. Mm-hmm. I get the ability to think, right? Most of us in this room, not all of us, most of us can think, right? And we make decisions based upon our thought processes and the gifts that we've been given, the true gifts that we've been given. We have, you know, two eyes, two hands. We're able to move about. We're able to make decisions that are at times rational. right? But what I'll do is anything that's going to conflict with the desire for me to drink is going to, I'm going to find the crack in that. I'm going to find the reason why that just doesn't work for me, right? And if my delusion starts to get threatened, I am going to absolutely come up with a reason why that doesn't work for me. Religion didn't work for me because I thought everybody who followed the religion was sheep. And look at what that preacher did and look what those people did. And look at how they ran their life. And anything to protect the way that my fallback position when I was drinking was that I had to protect at all costs my ability to drink in my own mind, and that to be okay. There was absolutely no chance I was going to give that up, and certainly not do it for religion when it was easy pickings to pick on religions for the things that I thought were wrong. I used my intellect to tear apart the very thing that could have introduced me to a path to God. Not necessarily one particular religion, but the concept that there are things available to me in religion, that these things, these you know, the three major religions of Judaism, Christianity, and Islam are, you know, they're huge. They're followed by people all over the world. They have gotten something from these things, right? Who am I, except in my arrogance and my pride, to say there's nothing there for me?
The other part that I really wanted to bring, that was brought to me when I first read this, was the part that I disregarded. You know, like, sometimes you'll hear people say, well, you can take that part of the step, but leave the rest. You know, if you just don't agree with it, that is not what we're supposed to be doing. So here they say, the rest I disregarded. So he totally admits there were things that he's being taught with religion and morals and principles. And he said, well, you know what, we'll twist this a little bit. I'll take on this, but I won't do that. Well, maybe that fits, maybe this doesn't. I don't know how you can relate to that, but I certainly could. You know, I kind of like made it so it fit what I was doing at the moment. Okay. But my friend sat before me, and he made the point-blank declaration that God had done for him what he could not do for himself. His human will had failed. Doctors had pronounced him incurable. Society was about to lock him up. Like myself, he admitted complete defeat. Then he had, in effect, been raised from the dead, suddenly taken from the scrap heap to a level of life better than the best he had ever known. Had this power originated in him? Obviously it had not. There had been no more power in him than there was in me at that moment, and this was none at all. That floored me. It began to look as though religious people were right after all. Here was something at work in a human heart which had done the impossible. My ideas about miracles were drastically revised right then. Never mind the musty past. Here sat a miracle directly across the kitchen table, and he shouted great tidings. That is absolutely a promise for step one. When I admit that I'm powerless and my life has become unmanageable, this is exactly what I began to see. Because I could see it in your eyes that you were telling me the truth, that your life had changed. I couldn't figure out why. So far, I didn't have the steps yet, but here it began, and this is the step one promise.
Yeah, and you know, the thing that took me absolutely years to understand, you ever see the guy who has the good stories in AA? He can tell you all the funny things about, you know, I woke up in a van with a, you know, a 6'4" transvestite, and the police were looking through the window, and you know, and my life's unmanageable, and the two thumbs up, and you know, they have all the great stories about the things that went wrong, right? I had all the great stories about the things that went wrong, but I had never made the admission, the spiritual part of the first step, right? There's two questions. When I drink, can I tell you exactly what's going to happen? The truth is no. I have no idea what happens when I start to drink, right? I might say I'm going to have two and go home, or three and go home, right? And I might actually do that. But that's a random event. There's no guarantee that's going to happen, and that's my best guess that night. And when the wheels come off, right, the confusing part for me is when I don't end up home, but when I end up, you know, seven drinks later thinking Staten Island's a great idea. It's just across the bridge. I'll be fine, right? Mm-hmm. They won't pull me over. And I can tell you the next day that it's because of her, because of him, because of them, because of the job. There's something happened, but it wasn't the drinking, because the delusion is firmly entrenched. It's not the drinking that's the problem. It's something happened that night. Bob showed up at the bar. I hadn't seen Bob in 2 years. We had a party. Something happened. Right, and I can tell you this, the horrible stories about how I went back to drinking after years of abstinence. But I never made the spiritual admission. I never said that my truth is a falsehood and that God's world was the truth, right? And in the mission presence, just like I was saying before a judge, I have to tell the truth. And that's there's the spiritual part of the first step. And we're going to cover that in great detail over the next 40-some-odd pages, right?
Yep. The other part that's really interesting is the question he asks himself, did this power originate in him? He knew Abby. He knew exactly what kind of guy he was. He knew what kind of trouble he'd gotten into. He knew that he had been virtually rescued from the hands of jail, insane asylum. He knew that. And it's like, where did this guy get this idea? Where did it come from? You know, he's listening to him while he's drinking, you know, and he's going, something's different, something's different. So he's beginning to see it. Something's different. Okay. He goes on to explain it, too. So there, I saw my friend was much more than inwardly reorganized. He was on a different footing. His roots grasped a new soil. Thus, I was convinced that God is concerned with us humans when we want him enough. At long last, I saw, I felt, I believed, and scales of pride and prejudice fell from my eyes, and a new world came into view.
Well, we're doing the original manuscript, so that may be missing.
I'll reread it. 11:6.
11:6. And these are actually incredibly important paragraphs, too.
They're very important paragraphs. No problem. I'm going to reread them for you, though. Okay. So I saw that my friend was much more than inwardly reorganized. He was on a different footing. His roots grasped a new soil.
Page 12, paragraph 5.
Thus I was convinced that God is concerned with us humans when we want him enough. Interesting, when we want him enough. As long last I saw, I felt, I believed, and scales of pride and prejudice fell from my eyes, a new world came into view. There's the condition. When you want him enough, when you want him enough, that's what happens. You see, you feel, you come to believe. The scales of pride and prejudice, that's what stand in the way. You're able to set it aside. And a new world comes into view. I don't know my story when I suddenly realized I was in a lot of trouble with drinking and other sundry items. But I was in a lot of trouble. And when I found that day, it was like 7 months into recovery, before I could truly tell you I was powerless over that. My whole life changed. It wasn't any great event, but it was like I really wanted it.
Yeah, and you know, this is one of the first times that he's really putting in place the idea that we have a common set of problems when it comes to character defects too, because we're going to talk about pride and prejudice,
mm-hmm.
right? And isn't pride the first of the seven deadly sins? You know, there are a variety of ways of understanding what ails me, and the most useful tool I have found so far to date in identifying my character defects, which we're all going to do, right, and later on when we do inventory, is the seven deadly sins, the sacrament of penance, which covers the seven deadly sins. It's also a pretty good movie if you've never seen it. But pride comes first, right? And you've always heard the phrase, pride goeth before the fall. But pride is where I take ownership of God's gifts to me, and I make them my own. Right? It's no longer something that was given to me freely by loving God, but it's, okay, yeah, I was pretty good at that, right? I did that pretty well, right? So I thought my way through that problem. I really don't need these religions. And prejudice is where I'm actually full of fear, so I've got to put you in your place. I've got to compartmentalize you into something that I can understand and grasp. So those religious people became, and God became this thing over there. And this is where he starts to get with God, right?
I also really appreciate in the original manuscript where he said, my friend has been inwardly reorganized. That's telling us about change. You know, that's telling us that things are going to be different for you. Hey, did you ever have anyone tell you you got your priorities messed up? Yeah. You know, that what the heck's wrong with your thinking? Okay, well, yeah, so inwardly reorganized. So, well, go ahead.
Just one last thing, too. This book is all about new, right? One of the most popular words in this book is about new. And right here they're telling us that a new world came into view. Mm-hmm. Would you go back to the old one? Would you want to go back to the old one, right? Living in an apartment full of fear. Oh, it was just me. Like living in an apartment full of fear, knowing that I was all wrong. You know, the best days back then were not that hot. You promise me something new, I'm in the game, because it had not turned out that well, the old ones. Sorry, go ahead.
The real significance of my experience in the cathedral burst upon me. For a brief moment, I had needed and wanted God. There had been a humble willingness to have him with me, and he came. But soon the sense of his presence had been blotted out by worldly clamors, mostly those within myself. And so it had been ever since, how blind I had been. Did you ever have that, those voices in your head? You know, where you have the conversations. Some people call them the committee this way. And then, you know, one thought's here and one thought. You'd be guaranteed one thought is always wrong. It's usually the first thought. So worldly clamors, what's he really talking about? He's talking about everything other than thinking about what really is the reality in front of us. It's everything else. It's the noise. It's the job. It's the money. It's the spouse. It's the kids. It's the, all the stuff before you can get, it's the worldly clamors about you. I really love that term.
Yeah, it's the things that we fill in the lack of the presence of God.
That's absolutely right.
So 13:1.
Mm-hmm.
At the hospital, I was separated from alcohol for the last time. Treatment seemed wise, for I showed signs of delirium tremens. I have not had a drink since. So there's a line of hope. There I humbly offered myself to God, as I then understood him, to do with me as he would. I placed myself unreservedly under his care and direction. I admitted for the first time that of myself I was nothing, that without him I was lost. I ruthlessly faced my sins and became willing to have my newfound friend take them away root and branch. What steps did we just cover? 4 through 7?
Yep.
Beautiful. Well, actually, in the sentences before 1 through 3, right?
Mm-hmm.
My schoolmate visited me, and I was fully acquainted with, and I fully acquainted him with my problems and deficiencies. We made a list of people I had hurt or toward whom I felt resentment. I expressed my entire willingness to approach these individuals, admitting my wrong. Never was I to be critical of them. I was to right all such matters to the utmost of my ability. I was to test my...
I wanted to say something about that paragraph. Look at the wording he's got here. He's got, my schoolmate visited me, and I fully acquainted him with my problems and deficiencies. He's talking about what's going on with him. Like what? Well, sort of like his step four. He's talking about what's going on with Abby. That's his acquaintance, right? And then it says, we made a list. So together, they looked at what was going on, and we made a list together. Nothing, absolutely nothing was done on his own. There's no way Bill could have done it on his own. I couldn't send you out and say, hey, you go make a list. You're suffering from delirium tremens. You're just getting out of rehab or treatment, and I send you out to go read the book and write your list. Bill say, no, we do it with you. We sit with you. We help you write that list. We go through it with you to help you identify root and branch, what's up. All he asked him to do was, Bill's thinking. He's thinking, well, yeah, this is going on and that's going on, and Evie might be writing for him. He might be writing that list of assets and liabilities for him. He might be writing it out to help him. And then he said, hey, let's go back. Let's find out how that's bothering you. But it's a we. Bill directs us right here. It's a we. That we did it together, that you're not sitting with all that stuff by yourself. I think it's a really important direction that has often been overlooked. Sorry, go ahead. I'm on a soapbox.
No, I have nothing to add to that. I'm with you. Next time you're sitting with a sick, twisted protege of yours and they're in the high occupancy lane because they have so many voices in their head, listen to what Karen just said.
Yeah, here, take out a piece of paper, and this is what you do. And that's what we learn how to do by going through the manuscript. It teaches us exactly how to help you or how you can help me. And it's always a we, that we work it together. Like when you're working with somebody and you're hearing it and you hear ego all over the place or you hear defiance, there's a really nice way of gently pulling them back and say, hey, where's God in this story? Didn't you fully admit or concede to your innermost self? Didn't you see that you of your own human aid can't do it? So what are we going to do here? And you can bring him around. And you can bring yourself around when you're like, okay, here I go again. I'm in me. And I'm in my delusional thinking. My delusional thinking wants to control. My delusional thinking wants to make sure it's okay. I removed alcohol, but I still got that hole in my soul not necessarily filled up with God. not necessarily filled up with doing the next right thing. Now, I don't know what that might be when I'm in my own head. But my sponsor and my spiritual guide certainly helped to move me out a little bit to take a good look at this might be possible as a we. It's a really important paragraph, so highlight it.
And, you know, one of the things that over the years I've looked at is how people went about delivering, the program of action to a newcomer, right? And I looked at the success rates of early presentations. How did Dr. Bob do? How did other people do? And the presentation of the steps was not this we'll do a step a year thing. You know, it wasn't this process of where we're going to spend, you know, the first 3 months writing on the first step to get an understanding of, how people have wronged you. The process was, let's get down and find out whether or not you're an alcoholic and whether or not you're willing to do the work. That's 1, 2, and 3. That takes 45 minutes to 2 hours with the guy. What happens after that? 4. It's inventory immediately. And the distance between 3... and 5 is the length of the inventory. And then when we do 5, the distance between 5 and 8 is the hour the book tells us, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
Right? Ebby delivered to Bill in the hospital this time a copy of Varieties of Religious Experiences by James, right?
Mm-hmm.
What was his full name?
William.
William James, thank you. Which I've always had a hard time reading. It's dense. But Bill devoured this in an understanding of what had happened to him because he'd had this white light experience, which he doesn't relay here, right? But he had that moment where he sat up in bed in a shock and a cold white wind blew through him to that effect. He had a moment. Now, I don't know what you guys think, but I doubt that Alcoholics Anonymous would have come into being if he'd had a moderate experience. I think that we enjoy sitting here today because he had that massive experience. I did not experience that. Mine was of the educational variety over time, where I had to disassemble my thought process because it was always in between me and a spiritual experience. But Bill was able to shed that in one night, right? Mm-hmm. And was able to sit down and actually get honest because he knew he had no choice. And there was no answer when he had no choice. That must have been disappointing. Right? He didn't have the knowledge that he could come here. You know, there was no here.
Not yet.
No,
not
there would
yet.
Be.
Go ahead, I was to okay. test. That's
okay.
what you're
so
at.
13.4, I was to test my thinking by the new God consciousness within. God's internal to me. Common sense would thus become uncommon sense. I was to sit quietly when in doubt, asking only for direction and strength to meet my problems as he would have me. 10 and 11. Never was I to pray for myself, except as my request bore my usefulness to others.
This is the first place in the book, or one of the first places, they're starting to give direction on what is called two-way prayer. In prayer and meditation. And it's used from the very beginning. So when you hear about prayer and meditation, and that's steps 10 and 11, don't freak out. It's from the very beginning that you sit quietly and say, wonder what that was about. And your thoughts get tested by self-will and God's will. And we're talking here self-will. Self-will is selfish, self-centered, dishonest, inconsiderate, and frightened. God's will, the four absolutes. So those were the tests that they put into place. That comes from the Oxford group. Those were the tests that they had right there. So you sit quietly with a decision, with a thought, with an action, and put it up against those benchmarks and say, is it a selfish thought? Is it a dishonest thought? Am I fearful? Am I being inconsiderate? I'm about to be inconsiderate. Is what I'm about to say or do going to hurt somebody? God's will about those things is that they're not. They're unselfish. They're honest. They're loving. And they're kind. And they're considerate. So when we're testing this, when we're talking about this new God conscious thinking, this is what they're referring to, and it's an Oxford group exercise to test my thinking in two-way prayer with God consciousness as my guide. So I can look at things and I can say, yeah, I really want to flip them off, or no, I'm really going to do that. I know that's my self-will, and that's probably why I'm uncomfortable. So he begins here to set into motion a new way of thinking. It's a new idea to set aside my old way of behaving, thinking, actions, attitudes, because we're getting down to causes and conditions, and he's starting to approach this idea of two-way prayer. And that's exactly where this is mentioned, one of the first places in the book. It'll go over and over and over, and you'll see these lines come up with the God consciousness within. This is what they're talking about, and that's as simple as they had it then. It's as simple as this comparison, that God consciousness are those God's will for us is honest, it's kind, it's generous, it's loving. It's the four absolutes. Self-will against it are all of those things that they trip up and they call them our wrongs. Are you fearful? Are you being dishonest? Are you inconsiderate? So when they begin to, when they mention that in the book, that is exactly what they're talking about, the God consciousness within.
Never was I to pray for myself except as my request bore my usefulness to others. Then only might I expect to receive, but that would be in great measure. 13:5. My friend promised when these things were done, I would enter upon a new relationship. Again, we're going to see that word new, with my Creator, that I would have the elements of a way of life which answered all my problems. Belief in the power of God plus enough willingness, honesty, and humility to establish and maintain the new order of things were the essential requirements. And the new order of things for me is that I'm going to get out of the way of me. I had to bring a blunt tool to my prayer life. The blunt tool was, shut up, Dave. It's not about you. Right? It was that, because whenever I had thought about me, I was always seeking something for myself. I had to honestly look outside of myself for how I could be of service without regard for what happened to me in the process. And that was the only way that I could get there, because that was because I would spend a lot of time trying to figure out how the answers would fit me.
I also like where it says in here, never was I to pray for myself except as my request bore my usefulness to others. Like, God, I am totally clueless. Do you ever feel that way? I don't know what to do next. What action should I take in this regard? You know, and then you put that out there as a prayer. That's an okay kind of prayer. It's like, I want to win the lottery. Well, not so okay. You know, that's not an okay prayer.
And the only requirements are belief in the power of God, enough willingness, honesty, and humility to establish the new order, which is that God's large and in charge. Simple but not easy. A price had to be paid. It meant destruction of self-centeredness. This is on 14:1. Simple but not easy. A price had to be paid. It meant destruction of self-centeredness. I must turn in all things to the Father of Light who presides over us all. These were revolutionary and drastic proposals, but the moment I fully accepted them, the effect was electric. There was a sense of victory, followed by such a peace and serenity as I had never known. There was utter confidence. I felt lifted up as though the great clean wind of a mountaintop blew through and through. God comes to most men gradually, but his impact on me was sudden and profound. Is this not a promise in the book? I asked the group, is this not a promise?
Yes.
All right.
They weren't very enthusiastic.
Well, we'll get them involved.
Okay.
For a moment, I was alarmed. I would be too. And called my friend the doctor to ask if I were still sane. He listened in wonder as I talked. Finally, he shook his head, saying, "Something has happened to you I don't understand, but you had better hang on to it. Anything is better than the way you were." The good doctor now sees many men who have such experiences. He knows they are real. Let's remember, we're talking about Bill's story right after the doctor's opinion. There is no answer to alcoholism. You might have a religious experience and be okay. You might hang on by your teeth, right, for some period of time, but inevitably you ended up back with Dr. Silkworth or dead or wishing you were dead. So Dr. Silkworth comes and visits Bill in the room that night, and he's a little taken aback. He knew that he was missing some piece of the puzzle, and it looks like Bill might have some sort of an answer. He doesn't know yet. He doesn't know.
No, he doesn't know, because he says he listened in wonder as I talked. He's seeing in Bill what Bill saw in Ebby. We can't explain this. You can't explain when you see somebody become in awe of what is up with them. can't explain that. There are no words for grace. Although I will call it fierce grace, because that's what we experience. It has to come at us fiercely for us to pay attention. But that's the result of somebody who's watched him go back and forth, whose eyes light up. And you know when you're watching somebody's eyes if they're engaged in this or not. You know it totally. So he's looking in wonder. He's in wonder going, oh my God, look at this. Hang on to that. Please don't change that. Right?
If you've been in Alcoholics Anonymous more than a few days, you've seen that person, haven't you?
Mm-hmm.
The person who's come alive. The person who suddenly realizes that there is actually hope. That there's something on the other side of this. That there's actually a chance to recover.
Yeah.
And they come alive, and they're goofy sometimes, but they come alive.
Mm-hmm.
Do crazy stuff.
I know.
Like workshops.
I also like where he mentions that these were revolutionary and drastic proposals. I know for myself, in my first experience, I'm like, you want me to do what? You know, I was kind of resistant to the process. And my resistance every time blocked off a change that inevitably needed to happen anyway. So when they say that these were revolutionary and drastic proposals, they absolutely are. So one of the things my sponsor kept saying was, how free do you want to be? I mean, what are you willing to do? How free do you really want to be? And I would say, well, I want it, but I mean, in my real response inside was, but I just don't know about your plan.
Mm.
You know, I just don't know about what you have to say about this. That's not going to happen for me. Here's where my objections would rise to the top. That can happen for you, but it's not going to happen for me. That's when they mention right after that, self-centeredness. You know, it's selfish and self-centered to think that the God of our understanding won't do for you what he's done for me. Alcoholics Anonymous proves that over and over again.
How much were you willing to do? Half? Three quarters?
Well, in the beginning?
Yeah.
Well, I just did it.
I was willing to do anything that didn't require action.
Yeah, there you go. Anything that wouldn't get me fired from my sponsor or something like that. But that's okay. I was willing to show up. And little by slowly, it rubbed off on me that maybe this isn't such a bad idea. But they are drastic proposals. They are revolutionary. They're totally new to you. So anyone sitting out with you, if you don't have a ton of questions, you should start talking about them. Because you do. I know you're thinking them. So ask the questions. Say why. Well, most of our answers are, we don't know. Stick around. More will be revealed. Let's see. What else will they tell us to do?
It's just silly.
Silly stuff.
Some of the best directions I've ever gotten in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous are, shut up. Just do it. Mm-hmm. And it turned out okay. And I didn't believe it when I heard it. I don't recommend it.
Well, here they give the answer to that. They say, the moment I fully accepted them, the effect was electric. So each time when my resistance finally was worn down and I said, all right, I'll really try, my life changed. It went in another direction for whatever it was I was engaged in. All right, I'll give it a shot. So now my life is, all right, I'll give it a shot. When you ask me to do something, I'll just show up, because you never know what's going to happen in just the showing up. But it took a long time for me to get there into this effect was electric. It was a good 3 years in recovery here, just coming, hanging out, before I'd stop resisting the process. It takes a while for us. It really does. And I hope you're discussing your resistance with your sponsor or people hanging out with, like, I think that's really stupid, or I don't agree with that. Keep talking about it, because it's good that you state it, and we can say, well, this is what it says in the book here, or this is our experience here, and we can help you through where you're stuck or where you're blocked, because they're just giving us the directions. Remember, this is a book of experience that worked for them and countless others, they tell us. So it's their experience. So all we have is that to share with you. It's our experience that we tried this on or somebody else. If you bring that topic up someplace, probably somebody in this room has been there, done that, and can tell you what not to do as well as what to do.
So we're going to read about what the definition of a spiritual awakening begins to look like in an alcoholic. It starts with the very next paragraph, 14:5. While I lay in the hospital, okay, he's not even out of the hospital, the thought came that there were thousands of hopeless alcoholics who might be glad to have what had been given so freely, has been so freely given me. Perhaps I could help some of them. They, in turn, might work with others. I had never thought about others. I really didn't care. I thought about me. I was the most important thing. You know, if loving me was wrong, I didn't want to be right. You know? And he goes on to tell him what Ebby was sharing with him, because this is an Oxford group principle.
Yeah.
My friend had emphasized the absolute necessity of my demonstrating, which means action, these principles in all of my affairs. That means work, relationships, my prayer and meditation life, working with other alcoholics, the random person I meet on the street.
It means everything.
Yeah, all is pretty clear.
Yeah.
Funny how that works. Particularly was it imperative to work with others as he had worked with me, because faith without works was dead, he said. And how appallingly true for the alcoholic. For if an alcoholic failed to perfect and enlarge his spiritual life through work and self-sacrifice for others, he could not survive the certain trials and low spots ahead. If he did not work, he would surely drink again, and if he drank, he would surely die. Then faith would be dead indeed. With us, it is just like that. You want to?
How many times, over and over and over, I thought I had it. I thought I had it all figured out. And then I'd hit the dead end. Oh, that didn't work. And it gave me every reason to drink again. Very rarely was it, like Dave, an experience where it was working with others. It was working for me. And somebody would say, well, how is your prayer meditation going? Or what are you doing? And it was always about me. Do you have time to go to this meeting? Or can you make coffee? Really? You want me to do that? You know, it wasn't about that. It wasn't about standing at the door welcoming you in. I remember the first time my sponsor gave me an assignment to be the greeter at a meeting, I almost died. You want me to, like, touch and hold hands? Welcome people in? It was so against where I came from that I found it an almost impossible task. And I was like, okay, if I don't do this, she'll fire me. But if I do this, I'm going to just like have a panic attack. You know, we're so into our own self. I was so into who, what I wanted, what I needed, what I didn't have, that it was such a revolutionary change of behavior to show up for you. I'm like, oh my God. It was only God who changed all of that. It's like, all right, I'll show up. Because I really didn't want to drink again. I knew that. I knew I didn't want to drink again. But the rest of it, okay. So here he says, he gives us all these directions. Practice these principles in all my affairs. I just wanted to die. Particularly as imperative to working with others. Don't you know how busy I am? And has you had worked with me? It's countless hours. I remember my first 12-step calls. My sponsor called me and said, come on, we have to go there. And I said, I am so tired. Do you ever get that dead silence at the other end of your phone? It's like, all right, I'll be right there. No idea how to get out of me to help you. I mean, I had kids. I had a good job. I had all that stuff. But it was so self-directed that the places, everything about me had to be put in place first before you. Since little did I know that it was the complete opposite of wording my life that would give me the life I was looking for. That's what was so incredible about that.
One of the most amazing things that happened to me was someone told me, oh, you're having a hard time? Great. Why don't you take the new guy out for eggs and coffee? And I'm like, that doesn't make any mathematical sense. I'm going to do for somebody else and somehow I'm going to feel better?
Yeah.
I would think it but not say it to my sponsor, but you're a moron. You know, that just is not going to work. And the first time I did it, I found out, I sat there. I was actually doing my four-step inventory for the first time, and I was sitting there talking to this new guy, buying him eggs. You know, he was unemployed. He was. I don't think I ever saw him again either. And I listened to his story, and as he was talking, I started to realize the stuff I needed to put down. And I flipped over the placemat, which had my Greek salad oil, and I started to write. And I had spent this conscious time in meditation over how to write something on my four-step, and all I could come up with was that they were wrong and I was right, you know? But sitting across from the new guy suddenly freed something inside of me that I had never had experience before with. I was actually free of self while trying to be of service to somebody else. I walked out of that diner thinking that I had been on vacation for an hour and a half. I just felt good, and it didn't make any sense to me. So I thought, I might try that again. Let's see what happens. and I did it again, and I did it again, and all of a sudden I realized the simple act of being available to somebody else was something I had never really done in my entire life. It had always been about me. And it was this sea change, this psychic change, this fundamental change that was happening, and it wasn't because I thought it was a good idea. It was because somebody had told me to do it, and I thought it was a stupid idea.
They also mention in this paragraph that unless an alcoholic failed to perfect and enlarge his spiritual life through work and self-sacrifice for others, here's the warning, he could not survive the certain trials and low spots ahead. He could not survive them unless we began to get out of self and relate to other human beings. We would not be able to do it. And as life goes on, I mean, life still happens, drunk or sober. Preferably sober, Your life still happens. And life happens on life's terms. I mean, my story is crazy in recovery. Crazy, crazy stuff happened in recovery. A lot more so than happened when I was using. Maybe that was God's way of using his hammer on me. I don't know. But all of our stories are different, but you're going to have life experiences come to you. Unless you are in this process of working with others and showing up and in the middle of the wagon, that period of time when life on life's terms happens to you might cause you to go out and drink, because it says if you did not, you would surely drink again. Well, that's a huge warning for me. That paragraph's a warning.
They're going to later on tell us why this is a fact. It's because there's going to come a time where the only thing between me and a drink is going to be God. Mm-hmm. It's not going to be you and your sponsorship abilities. It's not going to be because I have the golden book in my back pocket. It's going to be between me and God. And how do I get with God? I start to place other people's needs in front of my wants, and I start to be of service to others. That is an action that brings about a change that I'd never experienced. That is what a spiritual awakening looks like.
It's really interesting, as Dave was talking about working with a new guy in a diner while he's buying him eggs, and you're thinking, is he ever going to pay me back? The answer is probably no. But what happens is that I begin to see me in you. As you're sharing and as you're talking, and I can see all those things you're talking about. I'm starting to identify the resistance. I'm starting to identify what's tripping you up. I'm starting to identify the separation between God's will and my will. I can see it in you, so then I can bring it to me. That's how an alcoholic learns. That's how we can resonate with it, and that's how we can find the truth. And that seems to be the only way that works with us. Is to help with you. We were up in at the Wilson House, and a guy was speaking, and he said, you know what? I see God in skin, meaning that I see them in human beings. And that's how he related to finding the God in you, was the way you spoke to him or you were available for him. So it was important for me then to take on being patient with that newcomer, standing by the door no matter what, realizing it's not about me. Before, it was all about me. So if you need a hand, we hope you're there. And that's what he's telling you. If we don't do this, we're in trouble. We're in real trouble when we begin to pull that same isolation. Or we pull back and say, I'm too busy. Our very recovery, our very lives depend on our interaction with each other.
Why don't you go ahead?
Okay. My wife and
15-1.
I... 15-1. My wife and I abandoned ourselves with enthusiasm to the idea of helping other alcoholics to a solution of their problems. It was fortunate, for my old business associates remained skeptical for a year and a half, during which I found little work. All was not too well at the time and was plagued by waves of self-pity and resentment. This sometimes nearly drove me back to drink. I soon found that when all other measures failed, work with another alcoholic would save the day.
Promise.
Many times I've gone to my old hospital in despair. On talking to a man there, I would be amazingly lifted up and set on my feet. It is a design for living that works in rough going. So if you're connected, it's suggesting this, a huge suggesting, to be connected with what we call today your home group, to be connected with a network of men and women who you can call, to call those three people every day, to be in touch with other like-minded people who are seeking a different way of living through these revolutionary and drastic proposals. Like, a lot of it we don't get. We need to share it with each other. And a variety of recovery time, whether you're brand new or you've spent time here. It doesn't matter. We're all from the same place. Want to comment?
No, that was perfect.
Okay. We commence to make many fast friends, and fellowship has grown up among us, of which it is a wonderful thing to feel a part. The joy of living we really have, even under pressure and difficulty. I have seen 100 families set their feet in the path that really goes somewhere, have seen the most impossible domestic situations righted, feuds and bitterness of all sorts wiped out. I have seen men come out of asylums and resume a vital place in the lives of their families and communities. Business and professional men have regained their standing. There is scarcely any form of trouble and misery which has not overcome among us. In one Western city and its environs, there are 80 of us in our families. We meet frequently at our different homes so that newcomers may find the fellowship they seek. At these informal gatherings, one may often see from 40 to 80 persons. We are growing in numbers and in power. That is an amazing statement, that we begin to make fast friends. You know, I have some friends in AA that I've had. I had 24 years on Friday.
And
there's a girl that's still in my life since the very first meeting. She's still a friend of mine. I don't have those kind of friends from my drinking days. I don't have them. They are non-existence, basically, in my life. I just spent the weekend with my son and my daughter-in-law and my 3 grandchildren at Hershey Park, and I have to tell you, 24 years ago, they wouldn't have had me in their life like this. Nor would they have trusted me with their babies. They just wouldn't have. And we had a beautiful time, and they were saying, oh, we should do this again. And I'm like, yeah, we should do this again. I am so grateful that it has changed me to a place where feuds and bitterness of all sorts are wiped out. They're wiped out. When we live this kind of life, we become trustworthy. We become safe to be around. We're accountable. So they know we're not going to fly off at the next rotten thing that is said. And they're allowed to be who they're allowed to be. And I'm allowed to be who I'm allowed to be. It's like it changes as God enters into this. As I have a benchmark with him, as I do with my kids and my grandchildren. You know, you can see them for exactly who they are. I might not like some of the stuff that they're doing. It's really none of my business. And I'm quite okay with that. But the fact that I'm invited into their lives amazes me. Invited. They invite you in. I think of those times where I wasn't invited anywhere.
I think, in my family and in my extended family, I'm now seen as the rational one. And, I was the guy who said, like, in 1981, yeah, I'll be over for Thanksgiving. And then they saw me in 1984 for New Year's, you know.
Yeah.
I was missing in alcoholism. And they'd call me once in a while. I'll go to your wedding. Yeah. And I'd wake up that day and go, I am not going to that wedding. I am just busy right now. You know, I'm just not going to make it. And that has all come about as a complete sea change, right? I'm now the guy who most of the time, doesn't lose his cool. Most of the time is available for each and every member of the family. But here's an interesting part about this chapter. The early Alcoholics Anonymous was all about the family as well as the alcoholic. Mm-hmm. Am I carrying that with everybody that I'm working with now? Am I inviting the family in? Am I bringing a big book to the spouse, the significant other? Right? That's now become a very important part of how I sponsor today. I say with somebody who I'm going to work with, I need to meet your significant other. And you just immediately it gets quiet. Really? Why? Mm-hmm. That's in the book. That's why the family after. 2 wives. Right? This the devastation that I sow when I'm drinking or when I'm in an unrecovered abstinent state is horrendous. I am just a destructive force in anybody who wants to get close to me. I will bring you in and keep you prisoner for as long as humanly possible.
Mm-hmm.
Until I'm done with you. And I actually don't need a drink to be doing that. So I think it's incredibly important. And my family's a part of my recovery wholeheartedly.
So an alcoholic in his cups is an unloving creature.
16:1.
Our struggles with them are variously strenuous, comic, and tragic. One poor chap committed suicide in my home. He could not or would not see our way of life. There is, however, a vast among a vast amount of fun about us. Oh, boy. Vast among of fun.
It's actually, it was spelled incorrectly in the original manuscript.
I know
it was among.
It was. Vast amount of fun about it all. I suppose some would have been shocked at our seemingly worldliness and levity, but just underneath there's deadly earnestness. God has to work 24 hours a day, in and through us, or we perish. Most of us feel we need look no further for utopia, nor even for heaven. We might have it with us right here and now. Each day that simple talk in my kitchen multiplies itself in a widening circle of peace on earth and goodwill to men. It's an amazing statement about the openness that happens in the hearts of recovering alcoholics. That there is just that. That there is a lot of fun among us. And there is a lot of levity. Like, you have Earth people listening to some of our stories and they're going, oh my God, what is wrong with you people? Right? They can't understand that. But there is this earnestness. This is this earnestness about staying sober and being sober and having a contented sobriety to reach that level of peace and serenity. Nowhere does it say happiness, by the way. It says peace. It says serenity. Happiness is a byproduct of attaining that peace and serenity.
You know, it's funny. You can't go to your company party and say, hey, remember the time we scored that box of Percocet suppositories? Oh, my God. What fun we had that weekend, right? Because that just doesn't go over well. It's like someone slapped a 14-pound sea bass on the table, you know, just lays there, dead, you know. But we tell that story in here, and people laugh, right? Because we know what it's like to be wrecked together. You know, we sat next to each other in the same bar stools. We watched the tragedy. Oh, you know, I had the great pleasure of spending some time with someone today, and we went through some stuff, and I just went, yeah. I didn't do that, but I remember doing that, you know, because I was reminiscing about a place I never was. And the truth of the matter is we share this commonality about the things that we did. And we don't all have the same experiences, you know. You know, I don't know of anybody else besides Abby Thatcher who drove a car into somebody's living room, you know. I just don't know. I did other things. Similar, but not exactly the same. But it is in this. This is one of the things. This book is about relationships. In the fist up, I'm going to admit to God, myself, and to another human being the exact nature of my wrongs. There's only three things that are out there, right? Me, you, and God. It's about getting right with me, you, and God. And it's these actions that we take in opening ourselves up that create a fellowship that allow us to experience recovery in a way that is not available to Dr. Silkworth because he doesn't have the experience. He's never going to tell the crazy story because he just doesn't have that. And if you were driven by the things that drove me, if you needed that relief as bad as I did, you would have done the things that I did. And that's what defines us in our first step.
There are two parts as this chapter ends that really had impact on me. And it says there's two places where it says this is a present moment recovery process that we have. He says that God has to work 24 hours a day in and out of us. That means it's a day at a time. And the next one is that we need look no further, that we have it with us right here, right now. So it's imperative that we learn how to say, where are my feet? You know, what am I doing right now? Right here, right now. It's not about tomorrow, and it's not about the regrets of yesterday. It's about right now. What decision am I going to make? What action am I going to take? Oh, I don't know. Here, let me call somebody. It's that. He's giving it to us right here. He said God works 24 hours a day, right here, one day at a time, 1 hour at a time, sometimes 1 minute at a time. You know, you hear little slogans like an inch is a cinch. It's hard by the mile. You know, all of these things begin to make sense for us. Here it says right here, right now. So they're like, they're going to ask you that. You're going to hear that. Well, what are you doing about it right now? Is there anything you can do? How important is it? See, they're saying this to us right now. And that talk in that kitchen where he said, you know, you can have this too if you want it, multiplies itself. I think of the hundreds of people who have been in my kitchen, and I'm sure in yours too, that you've sat around and had these same conversations or on your porch or wherever you happen to, like, hang. My house, we have the porch.
Yeah.
I like what Karen said. You know, there's not a heartbeat that's promised. There's not a breath that's promised. All we have is this.
Mm-hmm.
So, open it up.
Open it up.
Let's open it up.